He's sit comfortably now. So today we've made the journey from our Rajgir or Rajagaha to Patna, and this city which we're now in was in the time of the Buddha just a small village called Patarigama. It's mentioned in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta as a small village, and the king Ajatasattu wanted to fortify the town first of all as a means of attacking the kingdom, or rather the republic, on the opposite side of the Ganges from where we are now, the kingdom of the Wajian Republic, centered around Visali, where we're going to tomorrow. So he built this huge city on the banks of the Ganges, soon to become called Pataliputra, what is now called Patna, and this was especially well known as the capital of the Emperor Asoka. And being the capital city of a huge empire, the Emperor Asoka was the first person who unified the whole of India under one rule, as a kingdom extending to Afghanistan. And also that it meant that this was a place, the centre, as it were, of Buddhism in that time, were huge monasteries under royal patronage. And it was also the place where they held what is later known as the Third Council. In other words, the First Council, we saw that at the Satapani Cave. Sometime later, when the Sangha was splitting and they wanted to find out some way of keeping the Sangha together, they held the Third Council here at Pataliputra. And the other thing which the Emperor Asoka was well known for, that he deliberately, under his royal patronage, sent out missionaries to different countries, notably Mahinda to Sri Lanka. And that is where Sri Lankan Buddhism came from, because Mahinda, the son of the emperor of this town, of this city where we're now sitting, was actually sent to Sri Lanka to start Theravada Buddhism there. But he also sent his monks to other places. He sent them to the land of the Ptolemies, to Egypt, and to the to Greece, to the Ionicus. In the time of Asoka, there was an emissary, an ambassador of the Greeks living here in Patna called Megasthenes. So there was many contacts at that time between. There's many contacts at that time between the Emperor Asoka and what we now know as the Western world. And so as such that the Emperor Asoka was a very important figure in the history of Buddhism. There's many stories about him told in the different texts, and my favourite story about the Emperor Asoka was that, of course, he had many, many brothers. He's supposed to have killed most of them to accede to the throne, but he couldn't have killed them all, because this story concerns one of his brothers who survived, but who still was not at all interested in Dhamma, not interested in Buddhism. And the Emperor Asoka wanted to try and find some way of inspiring some interest in his brother. So he used the following strategy, that he went to the royal bath, and having gone into the bath, he obviously took his crown, and or rather his royal turban, and all his royal regalia off on the bench, went into the bath to bathe, and arranged for one of his ministers just to be walking with his brother. And when his brother saw the royal robes with a royal turban just lying there, the minister said, "Hey, that's the emperor's royal regalia. Why don't you try it on?" And he said, "I can't do that, because it's one of the laws. If you actually try on the emperor's clothes, that's a capital offence. It's like usurping the kingdom." But the minister said, "Just try it on, just for a few minutes. No one will know. I won't tell anybody. The emperor's bathing. You'll be okay." And of course, if you had the chance to try on the king's robes, well, you may as well try it. And anyway, said the minister, one day, trying to push the vanity button inside this brother, he said, one day when the Emperor Asoka dies, now you're probably the one who will succeed him. So just try them on for size, because soon you'll be wearing them. So he put them on. And of course, as soon as he put them on, because this was a strategy, it was a trap, the Emperor Asoka emerged from his bath. And he saw his brother wearing the Emperor's clothes. So, what are you doing? So, I'm only trying them on for size. They didn't mean anything. What do you mean you didn't mean anything? Don't you know the laws of this kingdom, this empire? Don't you know it's a capital offence to wear the Emperor's clothes? I didn't mean anything. But the Emperor Asoka said, I have to be fair and just. It doesn't matter if it's my brother or anyone else. I have to apply the law without discrimination. I have no choice but to sentence you to be executed. And the poor old brother pleaded for mercy. I'm your brother, I never meant anything. But the Emperor Asoka was very firm. But he said, seeing as you are my brother, I will just make a little allowance for you. I'll postpone your execution for 7 days. And seeing as how you want to be the emperor so much, for 7 days I will give you all the enjoyments which I enjoy. You can have whatever food you like. You can sleep in the best beds. You can even have access to my wives. Everything you want for 7 days. But after 7 days, I will hand you over to the executioner for the sentence to be carried out. And he left his brother just to deal with that. And after 7 days, he called his brother. He said, did you enjoy the great food, the soft beds, and my wives in the 7 days that you lived like me? His brother said, how could I enjoy anything? I couldn't sleep on your soft beds. I couldn't even enjoy the food. You can't enjoy your wives. How can you when I'm going to die? I'm going to be executed. I couldn't think of anything else. I was so worried and so upset. And the emperor smiled. 7 days, 7 months, 7 years. How can you enjoy yourself with sleeping, with food, with sensory pleasures, when you're soon going to be executed? Executed by the death which awaits each one of us. And at that, the brother understood the Dhamma. How can we just enjoy ourselves when each one of us has a death sentence hanging over our heads? We could die at any time. 7 days, 7 months, 7 years or 70 years. What's the difference? And at that, the brother understood. He embraced the Dhamma of the Buddha and became a devout Buddhist afterwards. And that was one of the stories from the time of Asoka. How he made his dissolute brother into a religious person. And if ever you have got a relation, it may be a husband, it may be a child, it may be a parent who's not interested in Buddhism. Maybe you should try a trick, something like that. To try and get them interested in the Dhamma. But of course, Asoka, being a very, very devout Buddhist, sending missionaries all over the world, from this place here in Pataliputra, otherwise known now as Patna, there's very few remnants of his time here. Simply because this city has grown up into such a huge metropolis. Someone said it had about 5 million people here in this city. So underneath this city there's probably many, many ruins. Many, many places which hold the remnants of great monasteries. Such as the Gotamukhi Monastery, whose story I'm now going to relate from one of the sutras. Number 94, the Gotamukha Sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Venerable Udaina was living in Benares, in the Kamya mango grove. Now on that occasion, the Brahmin Gotamukha had arrived in Benares on some business or other. As he was walking and wandering for exercise, strolling around, he came to the Kamya mango grove. At that time, the Venerable Udaina was walking up and down in the open, doing his Changam, or walking meditation. Then the Brahmin Gotamukha went up to the Venerable Udayana and exchanged greetings with him. When the courteous and amiable talk was finished, still walking up and down with the Venerable Udayana, he said this: "Worthy recluse, there is no wanderer's life that accords with the Dhamma. So it seems to me here. And that may be because I have not seen the Venerable Ones as yourself, or because I have not seen the Dhamma here." That was just being sarcastic. He's just saying, just being a monk is a waste of time. And it's probably because all the monks I've seen, not like you, I haven't seen the Dhamma before. And when this was said, the Venerable Udayana stepped down from the walk and went into his dwelling, where he sat down on a seat made ready. And Gotamukha too stepped down from the walk. See, in those days, the walking platform would actually be raised above the ground, obviously, so it wouldn't flood in the rainy season. Those were the chankamas, the walking paths they had in those days. There was actually a building, not just a path swept in the forest. So Gotamukha too stepped down from the walk and went into the dwelling, where he stood at one side. Venerable Udayana said to him, "There are seats, Brahmin, sit down if you wish." But the Brahmin, being very proud, said, "We did not sit down because we were waiting for Master Udayana to speak. For how could one like myself presume to sit down on the seat without being first invited to do so?" So the Brahmin Gotamukha took a seat, sat down at one side, and said to Venerable Udayana again, "Worthy recluse, there is no wanderer's life that accords with Dhamma." In other words, there's no religious life which is really truthful and real. "So it seems to me here. And that may be because I have never seen real monks or real Dhamma." "Brahmin," said Gotamukha, "if you think any statement of mine is to be agreed with, then agree with it. If you think any statement of mine is to be argued with, then argue against it. And if you don't understand the meaning of any statement of mine, ask me to clarify it. Thus, how is this, Master Udayana? What is this meaning of this? In this way, we can discuss things." And so the Brahmin agreed. Now, first of all, to point out that this is how that monks, even great monks like the Venerable Udayana, would actually discuss things. If there's any statement that might be agreed with, then agree with it. If you don't agree with the statement, then argue with it. And if you don't understand it, ask about it. So whenever you're listening to a discourse from a monk, from a priest, or anything, anyone, do the same. If you agree with it, say, "Yeah, I agree with it." If you disagree with it, argue against it. If you don't understand it, ask questions about it. Just because you're a monk doesn't mean that you're beyond questioning. So whatever monk it is, please remember that. And so having agreed with that, so Master Dana, "I agree with this. If I don't agree with it, I'll let you know. If I agree with it, I will agree with it. If I don't understand it, I'll ask questions. In that way we can discuss things." So the monk began, "Brahmin, there are four kinds of people to be found in the world." "What four?" This is a common way of discussing things in the Dhamma. Four of this, three of that. And this is repeated from another sutta, so I have to go back to the other sutta to repeat it here. "The four kinds of people to be found in the world. What for? Here a certain person torments himself and pursues a practice of torturing himself. Number two, a certain kind of person torments others and pursues a practice of torturing others. Thirdly, a certain kind of person torments himself and tortures himself and also torments and tortures others. And lastly, number four, here a certain kind of person does not torment or torture himself, nor does he torment and torture other people. And since he does not torment or torture himself or others, he is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cooled, and abides experiencing bliss, having himself become holy. Which of these four kinds of persons satisfies your mind, Brahmin?" "And of course, the first three do not satisfy my mind, Venerable Sir, but the last one satisfies my mind." "Why?" says Udayana to Gotamukha. Venerable sir, the kind of person who torments himself and tortures himself, torments and tortures himself though he desires pleasure and recoils from pain. That is why this kind of person does not satisfy my mind. And the sort of person who torments and tortures others torments and tortures other people who also desire pleasure and recoil from pain. They don't like pain, so why should you torture them? That is why this kind of person does not satisfy my mind. And the kind of person who torments and tortures himself and also torments and tortures others, he does that to himself and others, both himself and others also like pleasure and they recoil from pain. That is why this kind of person doesn't satisfy my mind. But the kind of person who does not torment or torture himself, nor tortures or torments others, and who is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cooled, abides experiencing bliss, having himself become holy, that he doesn't harm anyone who recoils from pain, who desires from pleasure. That is why this kind of person satisfied my mind. Now I'm going to go back to where it was before. Here we go. That is why this kind of person does satisfy my mind. And so the mind continues. Brahmin, there are two kinds of assembly. What two? Here a certain assembly, a group of people, they like jewelry and earrings and see wives and children, men and women slaves, fields and land, gold and silver. In other words, people into material possessions. That's assembly number one. But another assembly does not lust after jewels and earrings, having abandoned wives and children, men and women, slaves, field and land, gold and silver, has gone forth from the home life into homelessness, and otherwise the monks and nuns. Now, it's this kind of person who doesn't torment himself or torture himself, and neither torments and tortures others. In which of these two kinds of assembly do you usually find this person, Brahmin? In the assembly that lusts after material things, or in the assembly which has renounced those material things and gone into homelessness, the monks and nuns? I usually see this kind of person, Master Udaina, in the assembly that does not lust after material things. The ones who don't torment themselves and torment others is usually found amongst those who've gone forth from the home life into homelessness. And Udaina continues, but only just now, Brahmin, we understood you to say, worthy recluse, there is no wondrous life that accords with the Dhamma, so it seems to me here. And that may be because I haven't seen real monks or real Dhamma. Certainly, Master Udaina, it was actually in order to learn that I spoke those words. And very often, it's the case, you say provocative words just to get a good Dhamma discourse. Sometimes you actually ask questions you know the meaning of, but you want to stir someone up to get a good talk from them. So he said this was his excuse. He said, I was provocative because I wanted to hear something from you. So it seems to me. And may Master Udaina remember me to have spoken thus, but it would be good if out of compassion Master Udaina would expound to me in detail those four kinds of person he mentioned in brief. What are the people who torment themselves and others, or do not torment themselves and others? Then, Brahmin, listen and attend closely to what I will say. Yes, sir, the Brahmin Gotamukha replied, and the Venerable Udaina said this. Brahmin, what kind of person torments himself and tortures himself? And here I've got to go back to Sutta 51, where it is repeated. And here we go. Here a certain person goes naked, rejecting conventions, licking his hands, not coming when asked, not stopping when asked. He keeps the one house for his food. He keeps the one source of food. He takes food only every seventh day, and so on, just even once a fortnight. In other words, he goes on to too much fasting. He's eater of just gross food. He clothes himself in things like a kusa grass fabric, which cuts the skin. He's one who pulls out his hair and beard rather than shaving it. He is one who stands continuously. He is one who uses a mattress of spikes. for his bed. He, in a very variety of ways, he dwells pursuing the practice of tormenting and mortifying the body. This is an example of a kind of person who torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself. And obviously we see this in some religions, the people who are into asceticism and austerities, even to the point of fasting. And what kind of person torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others? Here, a certain person is like a butcher or a fisherman or a hunter or a thief or an executioner, or one who follows some such other bloody occupation. This is called a kind of person, example, who torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. Now, it gives a strange description of the person who torments himself and torments others. Here some person is a noble king or well-to-do Brahmin, and they decide to hold a sacrifice. Having had a new sacrificial temple built, having shaved off his hair and beard, dressed himself in rough hide and greased his body with ghee and oil, scratching his back with a deer horn, he enters the sacrificial temple together with his chief queen and his Brahmin high priest. And there he starts the sacrifice. He says, thus, let so many bulls be slaughtered for sacrifice, so many bullocks, so many heifers, so many goats, so many sheep, that so many trees be felled for the sacrificial posts, that so much grass be cut for the sacrificial grass. And then his slaves, messengers and servants make preparations, weeping with tearful faces, being spurred on by threats of punishment and fear. This is called the kind of person who torments himself for doing a sacrifice and pursues the practice of torturing himself, and who torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. And of course, lastly, what kind of person, monks, does not torment themselves nor practice torturing themselves, and neither torments nor tortures others? Here, monks, and this here we go with what's called the gradual practice. A Buddha appears in the world, a person gets faith in that Dhamma, they go forth as a monk or a nun, abandoning a small or large fortune. Having gone forth, they possess the monastic way of life, the abandoned killing of living beings, with rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and kindly, thereby compassionate to all living beings. Having abandoned taking what's not given, they abstain from what's not given, taking only what is given, expecting only what is given, by not stealing, thereby the impurity. Abandoning into sexuality, you observe celibacy, living apart. Abandoning false speech, abandoning malicious speech, abandoning harsh speech, abandoning gossip. They speak only what is good. Speak on Dhamma and discipline at the right time. Speak such words that are worth recording, reasonable, moderate and beneficial. They don't injure nature like seeds and plants. They eat only at the right time. They abstain from dancing, singing, music and theatrical shows, and monks don't watch TV. They abstain from high and large beds, from accepting gold, silver and money. They abstain from accepting other possessions. They become content with the robes to protect their body and with alms food to maintain their stomach. And wherever they go, they set out taking only their bowl and robes with them, just as the bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden. So too the monk becomes content with the robes and their bowl. And possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, keeping the precepts and simplicity, they experience within themselves a bliss that is blameless. And then they practice sense restraint. And when they have sense restraint, they experience a different type of bliss, a higher bliss, which is called the unstudied bliss. Then they practice with full awareness in whatever they're doing. Keeping that awareness, a full awareness with what they're doing, that they resort to secluded places to meditate. It's interesting that one, in the traditional gradual training, that one starts with one's precepts first of all, learns precepts, learns contentment, learns mindfulness, and then goes off into seclusion to meditate. Sometimes people meditate too soon without getting a foundation of precept and virtue. And when one meditates, the first thing one does is sitting with the body erect, establishing mindfulness before them, which in my way of teaching is present moment awareness and silence. Then you abandon the five hindrances: sensory desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. Having abandoned those five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, you enter upon and abide in the first jhana. And then in the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. And then, having achieved the fourth jhana, one remembers one's past lives, one understands the law of karma, and then one overcomes the asavas, which is the word for the outflowings of the mind, and becomes the arahat. And that's the call to gradual training. And now, having called the gradual training, I've got to find out now where I was before in the other sutta, which, what was it called? Number
94.
94, there we go, thank you. Yeah, you are correct. So, and the expirant, okay. And then he, how is it? Finish off, sorry. Just, I didn't quite finish it off, number 51. I've got to go back again for this. Okay, when he knows and sees this, his mind is liberated from the asavas. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. One understands birth is destroyed, the whole life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. This is called the kind of person who does not torment or torture themselves, who doesn't torment or torture others. The one who, since they don't do these things, is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cooled, and abides experiencing bliss, having themselves become holy. That's the meaning of one who doesn't torment themselves or torment others. The arahat, the person who's been practicing properly. When this was said, the Brahmin Gotamukha said to the Venerable Udayana, "Magnificent Master Udayana, magnificent Master Udayana, Master Udayana has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms." I will pause there for a moment, because he was very impressed with the answer there. And the reason why I wanted to emphasize this is because the monastic life, or the path of Buddhism, even for a lay person, is not a path of tormenting yourself or tormenting others. When we were at the shrine in Nalanda, the guide there was saying about the meditation rooms, and he said a stupid thing. He said, "Oh, when people first come to this temple, they go in these small rooms, and you can't see any beds there. This is called meditation, but once they're finishing torturing themselves, then they can go upstairs to the next level where there are beds, and then they can study." And I think it's a crazy idea to think of meditation as a torment and a torture, but some people actually understand that, and some people even think that becoming a monk or becoming a nun is torturing yourself and tormenting yourself. As if, like, oh, you can't watch a TV, or you can't have sex, or you can't sort of go out and do this, you can't have an evening meal. That must be torture. And the Buddha is actually saying here, or Udayana is saying here, the quote before was from the Buddha himself, this is not tormenting and torturing yourself. It's called the middle way. And that gradual path is a way of ever-increasing happiness. So you're not tormenting yourself. And moreover, you're not tormenting others, because your life as a monastic or your life as a Buddhist layperson should be a harmless life, where you don't torture or torment others. So real Buddhism is not tormenting or torturing your husband, or tormenting and torturing your wife. Not torturing or tormenting yourself either. It's a very peaceful, calm life. So if when you meditate you think it's torture to sit there on the floor, on the hard floor, then that's not the path. You should go on a chair, because this is not the way of tormenting or torturing yourself. And if I forced you to sit on the floor for hours on end, then I would not be following the path, because I'll be tormenting and torturing you. And this is not the path of Buddhism. Here you make it quite clear the path of the Dharma is a path that fourth type of person, which doesn't torment or torture themselves, nor do they torment and torture others. That's why Udaina was very impressed with that. And so he said, magnificent, magnificent, magnificent. I go to Master Udaina for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of monks. From today on, may that Master Udaina remember me as a late follower, has gone to him for refuge, for light. Do not go to me for refuge, Brahmin. Go for refuge to that same blessed one to whom I have gone for refuge. Where is he living now, that Master Gotama, accomplished and fully enlightened Master Udaina? That blessed one, accomplished and fully enlightened, has attained final nirvana, po-nirvana, Brahmin. So this was actually after the time of the Buddha. If we heard that Master Gotama was in 10 leagues, we would go 10 leagues in order to see that Master Gotama. If we heard that he was 20, 30, 100 leagues, we would go 100 leagues in order to see that Master Gotama. We would go to that Master Gotama for refuge and to the Dhamma, to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today, then, Master Udaina, remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha for life. So even though the Buddha has passed away, you still go for refuge to the Buddha, the teacher of the teachers. Now, Master Udaina, the king of Anga gives me a daily donation, because he was a very senior Brahmin, and Udaina would actually give him some money from some of the village, like the tax would go to the Brahmin. Let me give Master Udaina a regular donation from that. What kind of regular donation does the king of Anga give you, Brahmin? 500 kahapanas, Master Udaina. Kahapana was a unit of currency in those days. Like $500. It is not allowable for us to accept gold and silver, Brahmin, which means money. If it is not allowable for Master Udaina, I will have a vihara built for Master Udaina. A vihara for that monk. If you do decide to have a vihara, a monastery built for me, Brahmin, then don't have it built for me, have it built for the Sangha at Pataliputta, which is the reason why I'm saying this sutta. I am still more satisfied and pleased that Master Udaina suggests that I give a gift not to him, but to the Sangha. So with this regular donation, and another one which I happen to have, I shall have an assembly hall built for the Sangha at Pataliputta. Then with that regular donation which he offered to Master Udaina, and another heap of money, the Brahmin Gotamukha had an assembly hall built for the Sangha, not for the monk, but for the whole Sangha, at Pataliputta. And that is now known as the Gotamukhi Vihara. But the trouble is, that was written a long time ago, and no one knows where the Gotamukhi Vihara is. But if we do find it, this says it was actually given to the Sangha, not to Gotamukhi, certainly not to the Indian government. So if we find it, the four monks here, we will claim it as indigenous owners of that vihara, which is the Gotamukha Sutta. So this was a story of one of the viharas which was actually built here at Pataliputta, which is now lost because of the city, because of the destruction of the Muslim armies, and also that the city growing up and covering up many of those ruins. But it's interesting here that this particular sutra, its main points are that Buddhism, the path, is not a practice of torment and torture, neither to oneself or others. Harmlessness, compassion, kindness and gentleness to oneself and others. Please always remember that. You may be kind to others, but sometimes you're not kind enough to yourself. You torture yourself, forcing yourself to try and get enlightened this lifetime very quickly. Come on. And of course that makes it even worse. This is not a matter of torturing or tormenting others, no matter what other people have done to you. Your job as a Buddhist is to be kind and gentle to them, not torturing or tormenting anybody. And the reason why that this Gotamukha got faith, he said, the place where you see that most of all is in the monastic assemblies. Real monks don't torture anybody, and they give themselves the highest happiness, the highest freedom from torture or torment. And that's why he got faith. And out of faith, he wanted to give a donation. And the good man said, "Don't give the money to me, because it's not allowable." He said that you want to give 500 prahapanas, which is a lot of money. It is not allowable for us to accept money, Brahmin. If it is not allowable to accept money, we'll give you a monastery for you, your possession. He said, "No, rather give it to the Sangha." So monks won't have any money for themselves, nor any possessions of buildings, but it goes to the community. And in those days, when it was given to the Sangha, as would be seen in many places, given to the Sangha, it's usually the expression was, from the very early days, to the Sangha of the four quarters, east, west, north and south. Not just to the Indians, not just to the local Sangha. All monks, present and yet to come. And of course, the present meant those monks in the time of the Buddha, yet to come, includes us four. So these monasteries were actually given to us. And so sometimes I feel like refusing to actually to pay to go into these places, because we're owners. The Sangha owns these places. When you go to Benares, when you go to Sawati, when you go to Waisali, sometimes there's a guard at the gate from the Indian Archaeological Survey, and they even charge monks for going in. We should actually be charging them, because it belongs to us. We are the owners. It's in stone. But nevertheless, if we did that, we'd be tormenting the poor fellows. So we shouldn't do that. So that's the Gotamukhi Sutta. And again, that Gotamukhi Vihara was actually built here in Pataliputta, one of the great monasteries which was here at that time. So, has anyone got any comments or questions about that? If there's anything which you don't, if you agree with that, say you agree. If there's anything you don't agree with, then you should argue. If there's anything which you don't understand, you should ask. Just as it said in the sutta. Yeah. Ah, yes. Okay. These were the preliminary practices before you go off and seek seclusion and really get into your meditation full on. And those things were just learning your precepts. In other words, learning a basic virtue, contentment, and mindfulness. So you're mindful of what you're doing. But if they say it's in going forward, you understand you're going forward, you're going backwards, you know you're going backwards, in eating, you're mindful of eating, even going to the toilet, you're mindful of going to the toilet, you're actually present, you know what you're doing. Because if you're not that mindful in your daily activities, when it comes to meditation, you're not going to be mindful of something even more subtle like the breath. And if you haven't got that purity from your livelihood, you'll find you're never going to be able to get that power of the mind, which is important in the later stage of the meditation. If you've got a beautiful mind, you like to be with that beautiful mind, you're still inside. The reason I said before why many people are restless, well, they can't stay still, is because they don't respect themselves, which is because of their lack of virtue, their lack of goodness, the lack of kindness, the lack of selflessness. Good people are at peace with themselves. Because they're good, and they love themselves. They look back upon themselves, "What have I done today?" Now, being kind, caring, forgiving, helping other people. You like to be with yourself then. But if you've been selfish, you've hurt others, you've missed the opportunity to help and to serve, and you think, "I don't like myself." And such people become restless. Well, that's one of the reasons why people go out and get alcohol or trying to distract themselves with movies or TV. They're not at peace with themselves, so they seek something to fill up or to escape. That makes sense? If you don't agree, as it says in the sutta, please say you don't agree. And maybe we can have some discussion about this, as it says in the sutta. So those are preliminary things. In other words, that if one isn't having a good virtuous lifestyle, at least a reasonable virtuous lifestyle, then one is too demanding, not really content with one's lifestyle, you'll find it difficult to meditate, because that contentment isn't there from the very beginning.
I thought the meditation helps you to be mindful.
Okay, it's true that it works the other way around as well. Meditation helps you become mindful, meditation helps you become content, and meditation helps you become virtuous. That is very true. But this particular gradual training was especially saying when you really go for broke, you seek seclusion. So you go on a meditation retreat. Then you should have reasonably strong virtue when you go on a meditation retreat. Or you go and spend a long time meditating, you really go for broke. Otherwise, for example, you know, that time when I went on a 6 month retreat in silence, if you didn't have a strong virtue and strong mindfulness, and strong contentment, you will never be able to stay 6 months by yourself. And sometimes people can't stay even an hour by themselves, you know, before looking for someone to talk to or something to do. Sometimes people come to our monastery and they say they want to retreat, and after 1 hour they're going looking to this person to talk with and that person to talk with, anything to do, except to sit alone, peace and quiet. And why is that? It's obviously they haven't learned that preliminary contentment. And haven't learned that sort of restraint of keeping precepts. So it does really help.
Precepts,
I just mean whatever precepts you want. 5 precepts is good enough, but it's just the heart of those precepts. And not harming others, not harming yourself. And sometimes you don't want to sort of just call it precepts and just focus on the rules themselves. That's like a manifestation of virtue. But you know, the root of virtue, where it comes from, is that purity of heart. Because not harming others, being selfless, wanting to give, not worrying about what you're getting, not worrying about what's in it for you, but just wanting to serve. You see someone hungry, you go and feed them. You see someone lonely, you go and talk to them. You see someone who needs something, you give it to them. That's the purity of heart. I've seen that with many people. They're just such kind, good people. They never criticize anybody. They never make it hard for anybody else. They're never fault-finding. It doesn't matter what happens if the hotel room is not absolutely perfect. Oh, it's good enough. They've got this pure heart. They're just so grateful. They just have a room to stay in. And they're so grateful what other people do for them. So they never criticize other people at all. And never criticize life. And the speech is just so soft and gentle. They see someone working hard. They don't want to give them a hard time by criticizing them. They usually praise them. They bend the truth just to make them feel good sometimes. You're doing a wonderful, wonderful job. You know, just what you're doing is really incredible. Amazing. Even though I thought, well, you could do better here, you could do better there. But you know, you want to encourage them. You're pure hearted. You think of others, you don't think of yourself. How can I give happiness to others? You know, the people are always ready to help and to serve. They're always there, sometimes at their own expense. They never think about themselves. They're just thinking of others. They're pure-hearted people. And you can recognize those in all societies, in all religions, in all places, in all countries. Those are such pure-hearted, kind, generous, wonderful people. That's what I mean about precepts. Does that make sense? Yeah. Go on.
I feel that even anatta is a good thing. I mean, it is good that it is looking for anatta. Whereas I thought if everything had a soul, then maybe it would never attain nirvana.
No.
It can destroy matter.
That's true, yes. If there was something substantial there to begin with, it would always be there. And if you have, this is a saying of the Buddha, if there is a soul, there's always things which belong to a soul. It's what a soul does. It owns things, possesses things, interferes with things. It manages, it does. And if there's always this doing, there's no rest. There's always business to be done. Things to own, things to possess. It'll be endless. If you understand the consequences of having a soul, having a self, oh, it's endless. Your job is never completed. It's wonderful if you understand how wonderful it is to realize there's no self in there, which everything can stop and disappear. You don't need anything. When there's a self, there's always things belonging to a self. It's called attachment. Many years ago, when I started thinking out, how can I stop all this attaching business? Because look, I became a monk. I gave up all my possessions and I gave up sex. And I thought, great, I've given that one up. But then I started getting into food. And so, you know, because as a young monk, food was very important. So I tried to give that one up. And you give that one up and you get involved in sleeping. Stop it. And so give up sleeping, get involved in food again. As soon as I put one thing down, I was picking up something else. And I thought, you know, how can you actually stop this? And you know what it's like is in the lay world. I mean, okay, you may be smoking. And it's like, I'm going to stop smoking. And then start eating. Stop eating. Then you start watching the TV. Stop watching the TV. Then you get into movies. Stop watching the movies. Then you get into something else. Always getting into things. And I thought, how can I stop all this attaching business? And then the simile came up to me, and there's something really strange about this, which I'll tell you afterwards. The simile came up to me like grasping, which is another word for attaching. This is what a hand does. It picks up things. And I cannot stop my hand picking up things. You'll watch me for the next day, even this evening, I always pick up things. Because that's what a hand does. So the only way of stopping picking up things is actually to cut off your hand. When you've got no hands, you can't pick up anything anymore. And that's actually the simile. If you've got a self, a soul, a me, you'll always be attaching to things. That's what the idea of me, I, a soul, a self, does. That's its function, that's its nature. The only way to stop attaching and picking up things is to abandon this idea, or penetrate to see its falsity, the sense of a self or a soul. For many years I thought that was my simile. You can imagine what happened when I was reading through the Sanyutta Nikaya and I saw the Buddha saying exactly the same thing. And that really made me shiver. I must have actually got it from a past life. Or just seen exactly the same way the Buddha saw. That's a Buddha simile. Simile of the hands and feet. Sanyutta Nikaya. If you've got a hand, you'll pick up things. You've got a soul or self, you'll always attach. So it's wonderful. The only way to let go of attaching is to have no one to do the attaching anymore. The only way to give up all your possessions is to have no one who's an owner. There's no owner in there. There's nothing to own anymore. It's freedom at last. That's actually how enlightenment happens. Seeing through the ownerlessness, the driverlessness of these five khandhas. At first, when people say, ah, that's a terrible thing. There's no soul, it's frightening. And they think, well, I can't enjoy myself anymore. And the idea of, you know, Ajahn Brahm's enlightenment being poof and you're gone. So, you know, like, that's unfair. I worked all this hard to become enlightened. I've given so much dana, kept all these precepts and meditated, given up so much and worked so hard to be a monk. Now, and then I've been meditating, I've got enlightenment and I can't enjoy it anymore. It's really unfair. Can't there be a place, some sort of heaven where enlightened beings go and enjoy their enlightenment which they work so hard for? So people get afraid when I say, well, poof, you're gone. I don't want to go. Why don't you want to go? Now that is attachment. That's the heart of attachment. You want to be. It's called bhava dandha, the craving to exist. That's a deep one. When you understand that, you can penetrate and overcome it. Then you can disappear. Emptiness is all gone. And when you actually understand the dandha, you say, oh, what a wonderful release. But to realize that you can just disappear and go forever. Be empty, merged with the nothingness, gone, nothing there. It's called letting go. And that's actually the beautiful part. And he chose not to be things rising and falling, as I've mentioned before. These things completely disappearing. things which you thought were always there have now completely gone. Similarly, which I've used. It's like many people think anicca is like the waves on a lake, rising and falling, rising and falling. The real anicca is when you're looking at that lake, yeah, you're contemplating the waves go up, the waves go down. You're contemplating this and then something happens. The whole sea just disappears, vanishes, and so do all the land and the mountains which hold that sea, which define it. Everything goes. That's real impermanence. Something which you thought was always there, stable, which was niyata, is now gone. It's aniyata, otherwise known as anicca. That's where. What is actually stable in you? What's always been there? What's the thing, the continuity, the continual essence of you? That's what you take to be yourself, the soul. When you see that disappear, you think what was always there, as stable as a mountain, is no longer there anymore. It's impermanent. My goodness, I don't. That's not me. It's wonderful to know that. Then you can just disappear. It's marvellous not to own anything. Then you're free. So yeah, it's great, anicca dukkha-anatta. This also happens to be true as well. It's more important. So whether you like it or not, that's what you'll see one day. And it's a beautiful thing to see. But that's why the Buddha said under the Bodhgaya, sometimes this Dhamma is just so difficult for people to see, they won't accept it. It's a bit troublesome for me, he said, teaching it. But Brahma's humbly said, there are beings in this world with little dust in their eyes. They'll understand that, they'll see that. So please teach. And sometimes reading the suttas, when the Buddha taught like that of anatta, many people became afraid. They became frightened. And some years ago, when I was in Singapore, which I visit quite regularly these days, I've been given many talks about two bad bricks, that the door of my heart is open to you, and all that sort of stuff. But this one time they said, Ajahn Brahm, can you give a deep talk for once? And they regretted it afterwards, because I really went for it. And a couple of them, they told me, one of them was the President Sun Han. He said, I didn't sleep that night, I was too afraid. Because he had faith that what I was saying was true. What I was saying just blew his mind. He couldn't sleep. He was too afraid. Because he thought that what I said might be true. It was. And that's it at the time of the Buddha. So some people get afraid of those teachings. That you don't exist.
Ah!
I want to exist. I want to be. But anyway, that's interesting. We're now, tomorrow, we're going to be going to Visali and also to Kusinara. And at Kusinara, we'll see where the Buddha stopped. Where he stopped being. Where he went poof. And disappeared from the whole of samsara. With no remaining at all. It's called Nibbana with nothing remaining. Was it Anupadesa Parinibbana? Anavisesa Parinibbana. Nibbana with nothing remaining. Isn't that beautiful? You see where the Buddha went out. That's coming tomorrow night. But on the way, we're going to Visali. And Visali again is a favourite place. I've just whet your appetite. Tomorrow morning, I think, we're still leaving at 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock wake up call, 6 o'clock is breakfast, 7 o'clock the coach leaves. And you know I was very strict today, when at the Patna Museum, those people who were late sort of had to find their own way back. So those people who are late, 7 o'clock, you're going to be in Patna, until we come back again in 2 years, 3 years time. We'll pick you up there. So, oh yeah, put your bags out, 6 o'clock. You got useless by now, outside your rooms, be taken into the buses. And then we go to Waisali. It's a very impressive place. There's two places we see there. One is the old monastery with a lion pillar, beautiful lion pillar. And that was one of the monasteries. And I'm going to ask you, I told one of the monks to answer this question, why there was a lion pillar? Why did they put a lion on top of this big stone column at Waisali? And see if you know some of the wonderful things which happened at that place. There's many stories because the Buddha spent a lot of time there. And it's one of the things which Sister Wayama is always very proud of at Waisali. And you may answer that tomorrow. Why was it important to the nuns, Waisali? And afterwards we go to the stupa, which is only a flat area and very, very small. But that's where the casket, which we looked at today in the museum, came from. And it was one of the places where the original relics of the Buddha were sent after the Parinibbana. We see that as well. The last time I was there, it was very powerful. I had a meditation, one of the best meditations of the trip, which means there was something happening in that stupa. So we're going to maybe do a little meditation there. Even though it may take a half an hour book, I don't mind being late, because that was a beautiful meditation I had, and I'd like to see if it's still there again. So that'll be coming tomorrow, Waisali. And it was also, interestingly enough, there was a republic, a democracy. We should be able to see, if we go on the right road, the remains of their meeting hall, their parliament, their sabha. Even over here, I think I was reading, I had a newspaper in my room, and I was reading that, and they call the assembly in Bihar, the sabha. Exactly the same word. We go past that, this on the road, between Patna and Waisali. And people in the West keep on saying that democracy started in Greece. And there was an old democracy in the time of the Buddha, in Waisali. We don't know actually when it started, but it was fully established and been going on for a long, long, long time. So it's wrong to say that democracy started in Greece, because democracy had also started in India, maybe earlier, who knows.
Good question,
though.
Democracy in Greece wasn't really actually democracy, because men of a certain class could join.
And that's exactly the same in Waisali.
No.
It was that the leading clans would have their members in the sabha. The riffraff wouldn't have much of a say. The servants, you know, the slaves, you know, the charioteers, the leading families would meet together. But it was a democracy, a representative democracy, just as in Athens. And I can't see why, you know, the people don't acknowledge just the contribution of philosophy and also culture from the East. And we go tomorrow to the cradle of democracy. Not Athens, but Waisali. Okay, the monk will have a packed lunch tomorrow, and probably maybe you will have one as well. Will they have one as well? You'll have a late lunch, a hot lunch. So it does not matter that. As monks, we can live very, very simply. We won't be tormenting ourselves. It might be tormenting you when you see the beautiful packed lunch we're eating on the bus. And you won't be able to have any of it.
That's on the eating
time. Yeah, because of our eating time. Yeah. It doesn't matter. We're not really worried about food. Okay.
Do you want to point out the Soka? The middle.
Okay, you've got some. You know the Moria? Do you know what Moria means? A hotel? Who knows? I've already mentioned some. Who knows what Moria means? It means, yeah, peacock, yes. And why is this called Hotel Peacock? Mora is M-O-R-A in.
Morian Republic.
Morian Republic, that's. Sort of close, the Peacock Republic. It was because it was the clan name of Asoka. He was called Asoka Moria. He was of the Morian clan. And that clan, the Morian, became the Morian Empire. So it was like Asoka was like his first name. Moria was like his clan name. So just like you get Sol Hanna, you like the Hanna clan. Asoka was of the Moria clan. So this was the Republic, named after Peacock. So Asoka Peacock would be his name. Like an Andrew Peacock in Australia. Which may be a descendant of the And that's what Moria means. And you've got those, oh, I can't see them all there, but what's the first one?
A
bull. Heifer. Okay, what's the second one?
Lions.
How many lions are there? One or four?
Can't see.
Maybe there's supposed to be a fourth one behind there, but we'll mention that. What's the next one behind there? A horse. And what's the next one after that? Now that would be very interesting, because remember that, I'm going to ask you a question about that when we go to Sarnath. You've got a bull, a lion, a horse, and an elephant. Remember those four. You see those in different places on Asoka columns. And also you see them underneath Asoka columns. And there's a reason for that. Remember that. Tomorrow we're going to see one with just a single lion on it. And I'm going to ask you, I've already mentioned this, see if anyone can understand why Asoka put a lion on top of that pillar at Waisali. Okay, well that's for you to think about. Okay, so there is a little ceremony to be made before we go, because Sol and Clive's grandfather died a couple of days ago, and they wanted a little Sangadana offering of these robes. So those who are really, really tired, you can go back to go off to bed. But if you want to just watch it like an act of giving, especially in honour of the grandparent who passed away, we can do that now. Do you want to take hold of the ropes? One each, yeah. Okay, do you want to repeat after me? You think you can hold two in your hand, and you can hold two in your rope hand, first of all, hold two. Okay, say after me, Imani, Mayang Bante, Pangsakula, Shivarani, Bhikkhu Sangasa, Ono Jayama, Sadhu No Bante, Bhikkhu Sankho, Pangsakula, Shivarani, Patigamhatu, Amhakang, Dikaratang, Itaya, Sukaya. Sadhu, which means, hang on. Which means that, Venerable Sirs, we'd like to offer these robes to you. And may the Sangha receive these robes for our long lasting happiness and the benefit, and also for long lasting happiness and benefit of your grandfather who passed away recently. And now you can say, Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu. You know what that means, sadhu? It means it is well, or congratulations, or marvellous, well done. Very good. Well, now you can do one each. Okay. And now we just give the quick blessing for your time. Anicca vata sankhara upadavaya dhammino upajjito anirujanti te sang upasamo sukho. Anicca vata sankhara upadavaya dhammino upajjito anirujanti te sang upasamo sukho. Anicca vata sankhara upadavaya dhammino upajjito anirujanti
Tezang Vubhasamo Sukho.
And now if you'd like, especially you two in front of here, could actually repeat the verses of sharing of merits.
Yidang Me.
Yidang
Me. Yatinang.
Yatinang.
Hotu.
Hotu.
Sukhita.
Sukhita.
Hontu.
Hontu.
Yatayo.
Yatayo.
Yidang Me.
Yidang Me.
Yatinang Hotu.
Yatinang Hotu.
Sukhita Hontu.
Sukhita Hontu.
Yatayo. Yidang Me.
Yidang Me.
Yatinang Hotu.
Yatayo.
Sukhita Hontu.
Sukhita Hontu.
Yatayo.
Which means that this of ours, this merit of ours, may it be for the happiness of our relations. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So this is a dedicated merit. Okay, let us finish. Okay, and now we're going to double your merit for your grandfather, because we're going to give these to other monks. Thereby, not going to go just to one monk, but going to many monks. And we're going to share the merit of our giving to other monks with your grandfather. Okay, so now let's put to the Arahant Sama Sambuddha, and then we can go ahead with the rest.
Arahant Sama Sambuddha Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadeng. Suvākhāto bhagavatā dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi. Supatipanno bhagavato sāvakasangho saṅkhaṃ namāmi.
Okay, so good night everyone. See you at 6 for breakfast.